The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am Neil Pollack. I am the host of this program. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and we have an excellent show for you this week, discussing a lot of thoughtful issues in the world of entertainment. Contributor Jamie Mason will be here to talk to me about Amazon's purchasing of the James Bond intellectual property. And Jamie, who has written a James Bond novel, legally, mind you, will talk to me about what this means for the future of the James Bond franchise. Very interesting conversation coming up. I'm also going to be joined by chief film critic Stephen Garrett to talk about the life and work of the actor Gene Hackman, who died this week at the age of 95 under somewhat bizarre circumstances, I have to say. We're going to mostly talk about Hackman's movie acting, although we're going to gossip a little bit about his strange death. It's kind of hard not to. But first, I'm going to talk to new Book and Film Globe contributor Jacob Harper about something that's come up recently in film circles about the increasing shrinking theatrical window for movies. Director Sean Baker, the director of Anora, has been calling for a 90-day theatrical window for new releases. It will really help mid-budget movies find an audience before they're released into the streaming ether. Jacob wrote a great piece about this for us, and he will be along to talk to me about it after this musical interlude. The actor Gene Hackman has died at age 95, and there has been, including on Book and Film Globe, a lot of tributes, a lot of praise about Gene Hackman. Everyone loved Gene Hackman, and Stephen Garrett has joined me. He is a man of much film knowledge.
Hello.
And hello, Stephen. So, but before we start talking about what was great about Gene Hackman and our favorite Gene Hackman performances.
What was bad about Gene Hackman?
Yeah, exactly.
Was there anything bad about it? Maybe Welcome to Mooseville, his last movie.
Mooseport.
Yeah, I can't even remember. Can't even diss him right. I love him too much.
That wasn't his fault. But yeah, he made some bad movies. He made lots and lots of movies, and they weren't all good. But the point is, it's not like he died of natural causes. Well, he might have, but what I'm saying is this isn't just like, oh, he was 95 and he died. It's not like when Kirk Douglas died. You know, it's like this, who we had been seeing photos of Kirk Douglas like laying in bed for the last 3 years. You know, Gene Hackman was last seen coming out of a Papado's Louisiana kitchen in New Mexico with his wife a year ago. And the circumstances surrounding his death are very bizarre, right? Like, he was found dead in the mudroom, and his wife, who was 30 years younger than him, more than 30 years younger than him, was found dead in the bathroom with an open pill bottle. And there was a dead dog in the bathroom closet. So all I'm saying is I have no idea what happened. And it's, in some ways, it's only my business in as much as, you know, I like, everyone loves a true crime story, but I'm just saying, like, this was not an ordinary Hollywood death, I don't think.
Well, I is there such a thing as an ordinary Hollywood death? I think this
Kirk is... Kirk Douglas.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, if he's the baseline, then yeah, this is slightly more unordinary.
It's a strange story. It's a tabloid death.
I think his death, I read somewhere that, like, he had fallen down, his glasses were kind of strewn nearby, like they fell off his face. It seemed like he took a tumble and then died, which totally makes sense. He's 95. He was frail. There was a cane near his dead body. So I don't think that's unusual, but I think what's unusual is that the wife and dog were both dead. I don't mean to laugh, but that is a crazy...
It's a crazy
like,
story.
Yeah, if my obituary is like, they found me dead along with my wife and dog dead, like, wouldn't that be... That'd be a way to go.
It's a way to go. So all I'm saying is, like, it's hard to say, you know, it's not when we talked about David Lynch dying a few weeks ago, you know, he had emphysema and he died, and, you know, it was sad.
but he died in a normal way. This is not, these circumstances were a little odd. So we have to mention that, because otherwise it just seems like this is a normal death, which it probably isn't.
It's very New Hollywood. It's very like, if there's a 70s actor who's going to die, this kind of tracks.
Well, this is what I was going to say about Gene Hackman. He's like, yes, in my mind and in your mind, he is a 70s actor. But I posted something about him on Facebook and, you know, asked people to sort of tell me what their favorite Gene Hackman performance was. And of course, I'm, you know, the film hipster that I am. I was like, well, I loved him in Scarecrow and in Night Moves and The Conversation, you know, all the realistic New Hollywood performances he gave. That sort of made Bonnie and Clyde, you know, that made his reputation. But someone else was like, what about Hoosiers? You know, I'm like, well, and then someone's like, Crimson Tide. Everyone was like, Crimson Tide. I'm like,
Get Shorty. I love Get Shorty.
Yeah. So there, you know what I mean? Like he definitely escaped that sort of 70s label and made movies. You know, he was in The Royal Tenenbaums, which is a very twee, perhaps the tweeest movie ever made.
Certainly the tweeest movie he was ever in.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly right. And he just sort of, you know, I know it's a great movie, but I mean, it has very little in common with Crimson Tide.
Right. And he and Wes Anderson apparently tussled, right? Didn't they get into it a bit? There's a little friction between the two of them.
Yeah, that's not a match made in heaven. You know, he was much better suited working with sort of the, you know, directors of the 70s. And I looked, you know, I was like thinking about it, like, you know, worked with Francis Ford Coppola and, you know, and well, but, you know, so you think, when you're thinking about your favorite Gene Hackman performance, I mean, there's really only one choice, and that's Lex Luthor.
I mean, yes. Of a certain age, yes. I think for both of us, that was defining. It was so funny.
Yeah.
Love it.
So funny. And you know, and there's been a lot of actors who have played that character. Other than the guy who maybe did the voice of Lex Luthor in the Justice League cartoons. He was Clancy Brown. He was the best. You know, he was the best at that.
May I posit, in an era before Robert Downey Jr., Gene Hackman absolutely nailed the sort of attitude you should bring to a superhero movie.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it was gruff, it was funny, it was mocking, it was deadly serious, it was like everything. It was all the colors.
Yeah, it was perfect. It's a perfect performance. I don't think he got any nominations for that performance, but
no, just a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money. But I think in a modern age where it's acceptable to nominate some superhero movies for some Oscars, that might have actually weaseled its way into the conversation.
Yeah. Well, that was back in a time where you did the arty movies and then you made the popcorn pictures and you got a lot of money for the popcorn pictures.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people saw the popcorn pictures because movies were still a mainstream kind of entertainment. Like, he'd make Night Moves, and then he'd make Superman.
Right.
And the Poseidon Adventure. You know, he'd make Scarecrow, and then the Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah, basically at the same time.
Yeah.
I do love Scarecrow, but that's not a movie that, you know, it's not an easy movie to watch. I mean, that's like a...
It's an arty movie, but I think watching him in it, you realize how much fun he had as an actor and how much fun he had working with people he admired and wanted to riff off of, like him and Pacino. The rapport they have in that movie is really unique, and it's not something you find in either of the movies that either of them made, or I mean any of the movies that either of them made afterwards.
Yeah, and the thing about Hackman, right, is that, you know, he didn't really start acting until he was in his mid-30s. He was in the Marines. He was a broadcast journalist, you know, and he was a stage actor for many years, and so he brought a kind of gruff realism to a lot of his characters that you don't see from, you know, a lot of actors, even the good ones now, feel a bit prepackaged maybe and a bit plastic.
No, you got a sense. Yeah, he had lived a life, right? Like he didn't grow up on screen. He clearly suffered the slings and arrows of his life, right? Like, you know, he had been in the army. He had been around. He had failed. He had had modest successes, but you know, he wasn't a movie star out of the gate, and nor does he have movie star looks or kind of a posture, you know, but he just has this incredible charisma and a machismo that full machismo's wrong. He was very masculine. He was masculine in the true sense.
He was a sort of archetypal greatest generation guy.
Right.
Like, you know, he was too old to be a boomer. He was 95.
Right. But he was too young to go to World War II, right? He would have been 15.
Barely. He joined the Marines in the 40s, late 40s, but like spent time deployed in China.
Right.
I mean, in the 40s and early 50s, that's not exactly a cupcake post.
You know? But you got the sense that he had seen the world, he had lived life, you know, and like behind his roguish smile and his charm, there was a deadly serious, you know, almost kind of existential sort of reaction to how dangerous the world could be and the people around him. Like
Lex Luthor, like menace. Yeah.
Yeah. He was menacing in a really charming way.
Well, and that's why, you know, when I decided to do a little Hackman tribute piece, our the boss of Book and Film Globe of Sia Reed's Media immediately mentioned Night Moves. Like Night Moves is, you know, which is a movie that I only watched for the first time 2 or 3 years ago, is really
do you like it?
God, that movie's great. It's like reading a John D. McDonald novel. You know, it's a classic noir, but with like a very kind of 70s sweaty vibe to it. You know, it kind of goes between Los Angeles and Florida, two great noir locations. And you know, Hackman's character is such a loser.
Yeah.
He's this ex-football player turned private eye. You know, that character, and then George Segal's character in California
Split
are like my favorite sweaty 1970s losers. And those two performances to me just define the 70s. And so that movie is just, you know, like a lot of noirs, like the plot doesn't really hold together.
Mm.
You know, it's a lot of MacGuffins in it, but his performance is so magnetic and just like,
maybe that's the key though. Like Hackman kind of played people who were kind of losers.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe they were villainous, but they were sympathetic, and maybe they were heroes, but they were shaded and they weren't completely heroic. Like there was something off about him, something a little skewed.
What I saw the post was like, you know, Gene Hackman to us was always an old man. You know, he was an old man in the conversation, and he was a really old man when he died this week at age 90.
So old. Wow. I mean, and I don't know if you saw photos of him. I mean, it was hard to recognize what he looked like. And that's like, 95. Sometimes we care for what you wish for, a long life.
But you look at photos of old Dick Van Dyke and you think, oh, that's old Dick Van Dyke.
That's true.
Or old Mel Brooks. You're like, oh, that's old Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but Gene Hackman wasn't dancing every day. he was eating at Papado's.
Yeah, he wasn't having lunch with Carl Reiner every Friday. Or
watching Jeopardy every day with Carl Reiner. No, but the old photos of old Gene Hackman. The only other Hollywood star I remember looking at when they were that old was I remember what Tony Curtis turned into Gollum. You know, at the end, it happens. If you live long enough, it does happen. But I don't know. I mean, I love all the Gene Hackman tributes this week. I think they're totally apt and they're totally apropos. And you get both the best of both worlds with this. You get to like pay tribute to a long and glorious, one of the greatest careers in Hollywood history.
Oh, yeah.
Double Oscar winner, beloved by everyone.
And on his own terms, you feel like this is a guy more who made choices not because his agent said, you need to do this, but more like, oh, I want to work with that guy or want to work with this. And somebody who a dramatic actor who did a lot of comedy.
Yeah. Well, the scene in Young Frankenstein where he stole the show, his turn in The Birdcage and Drag.
Birdcage is hilarious.
A lot of good stuff. So you have that. And you also have all the juicy, true Hollywood story gossip about his death.
That's right. You're welcome, America. Gene Hackman, always the entertainer to the end.
His final performance. All right, Stephen Garrett, thank you very much. You hold your wife and dog close tonight.
I will. We're all going down together.
One of the big issues with film right now is that a movie comes out and then it disappears almost immediately. It'll be released in theaters and suddenly you won't have the option to see it in a theater anymore. It's called a theatrical window, and it is increasingly shrinking and has been for the last few years. And we published an article on Book and Film Globe this week by Jacob Harper, who is a new contributor to us. He is a filmmaker and a movie critic who lives in Dallas, Texas. And Jacob is here today with me to talk about the issue of the theatrical window. Hello, Jacob.
Hey, Neil, thanks for having me.
Yeah, always. Well, I say always a pleasure. It will always be a pleasure. The next time I have you, it'll be a double pleasure. But yeah, so the reason I asked you to write this, because you pointed this out on X. You talked about the theatrical window of this movie called Companion, which we've talked about on this show before. A movie that was one of my favorite movies of the year, and I think it will be on my top 10 list at the end of the year. And it's already gone from theaters.
Yeah, yeah. I was really shocked by that because it came out January 31st, and 17, 18 days later, it's on. It's going to be on video on demand. It's already on there, which was shocking to me because it was like just in theaters.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it at the Alamo Draft House here. On a weeknight in a pretty big theater, and there were, there were people in there, 50 people in the theater or whatnot. And then the next week I went back to the Alamo to see something else, and it was in one of the tiny side theaters where there were, maybe 15 people who could even see it, maybe 20, 25 at most. And then it's just gone. And, it's just, I feel like Companion is a movie that if it had been marketed differently, I don't think it would have been a massive blockbuster.
Right, right.
But I think it could have found an audience.
It was a fun, like 90-minute, almost 2 hours, like thriller. And it seemed to be pretty mid-budget, which is kind of the type of movies you don't see that much anymore. A lot of budgets are super bloated and super long run times, which I'm all for long run times. But, it felt like one of those movies that at a certain point in time would have done super well in the theaters and would have had a mass audience and been in the theaters way longer than it was.
Yeah, and it was the type of movie, too, that, I thought the marketing for it was pretty bad. Like, I didn't really know what I was getting when I went into it because it just kind of had that... basically, it was just a scene that actually appears in the movie toward the end where your heroine, so to speak, is, holding her hand over a candle. And you thought it was just kind of like some sadistic relationship torture movie. And, I know that my wife specifically was like, well, I don't want to go see that. And I came home and I was like, that movie was great.
Yeah.
And that advertisement really did not do it justice. So I feel like there's a lot to... at fault here. Like, I feel like who put it out? Wasn't A24, right?
It was, I believe, New Line. Cause that was one thing on my tweet. A lot of people were like, this isn't a big budget movie. It's made by New Line, which I think New Line is a pretty reputable, fairly sized studio. And I believe it's also owned by Warner Brothers, one of the biggest studios. So I thought that was an odd, defense for it being taken out of the theater so quickly.
Well, I just feel like they should have given it a chance. That's not to say it's not going to find an audience on streaming. Eventually, it's going to go to a streaming service.
Right.
It's not just going to be video on demand. It's just like, for instance, Zach Kreger's Barbarian, which I'm sure, I can't imagine that's not a movie you don't love, right? Great, great film. I eventually saw it on streaming. Like, I didn't see it in the theater. I discovered it on streaming. But, now I'm like, I wish I'd seen that in a theater, right?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a lot of movies like that. Like, I remember I watched The Menu for the first time like a year or so back, and I was so mad I didn't catch it in the theater because I ended up loving it so much more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I actually saw The Menu in the theater because, you live in Dallas, so you have an Alamo. That thing was promote every time I went to the movies for a year, I saw a trailer for The Menu. I was like, oh, I got to see The Menu.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's a movie that, it just found an audience on streaming. I don't know if it's considered a classic, but it's certainly something that gets referred to and memed a lot, right?
Right.
So yeah, but you're right. It's like these mid-tier genre movies, movies that really should be like filling up the box office. And then there's but at least Companion had a theatrical release at all. Then there, I was shocked when I went on Amazon Prime, and I am a member of Amazon Prime. I know it's cool to support Amazon and. Anyway, but I like getting my monthly shipment of mints. But I went on Amazon Prime and they were advertising this Will Ferrell, Reese Witherspoon kind of wedding comedy.
Right.
First of all, I'm like, Will Ferrell is a wedding dad now? That made me kind of sad. But I was like, doesn't that movie belong in theaters?
Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about it. I saw one trailer for it. And with that type of star power and that sort of rom-com-esque premise, I feel like that would have been big in theaters 5-10 years ago, and now it's a straight to streaming kind of quick buck type thing, and I think that's it's interesting.
Yeah, or like Cameron Diaz's big comeback movie. She made that movie with I believe it was Jamie Foxx. you know, it's like the same premise in every other movie that they make, where they're retired spies and they have to, you know, in living in the suburbs, and they have to come out of retirement for an adventure or whatever. It's a genre I don't like, but I'm like, you know, Cameron Diaz hasn't made a movie in what, like 10 years?
Right.
And that's her comeback on Netflix? Come on. I don't know. I know that, like, you know, when I'm much older than you, but like, you know, when I was a kid, like, movie stars who were huge in like the 40s and 50s, like say Barbara Stanwyck or something, were like appearing on Columbo or like starring in some Dallas or Knott's Landing or whatever. So it's not like there's never a tradition of like big movie stars dropping down a peg, right? But this is a distribution issue, I think.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like Sean Baker, who directed Anora, which I would say is the favorite. By the time this appears, we'll know who won Best Picture, but I would say Anora is a strong contender to win Best Picture this year. He's been out there talking about this 90-day theatrical window.
No, yeah, I loved his speech at the Spirit Awards.
Yeah,
where he talked about he shouted out Terrifier, which had a huge box office return that like no one saw coming. But for the most part, like, movies have way too high of budgets, and that sets unrealistic expectations at the box office. So now most things coming in and out of the theater are like destined to fail. It's insane how much money is being poured in with how little is returning because of shrinking theatrical windows. And I mean, there's a million other factors, as I pointed out on X.
Yeah, let's talk about those. So there's two factors that I think are interesting. One, you know, you weren't around during the pandemic. I mean, you were around during the pandemic, but you weren't around with us during the pandemic. I spent a lot of time desperately trying to get people to go back to the movies because I never stopped. I was an anomaly, I realized. But they were, you know, we live in Texas. They were open. So I was trying to get people to go back. No one was listening. And, you know, I think that there was a behavioral change that occurred in a good chunk of the public, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It was a huge hit to the industry, and it still hasn't recovered.
Yeah, and it may never. It got people out of the habit of going to the movies. And then there's something you mentioned, too, which is that, you know, I mean, I pretty much just go to the Alamo or to the Austin Film Society, where audiences are forced to behave well.
Right.
Like, more or less. I mean, yeah, in the Alamo, you have to deal with people smacking on their chicken wings or whatever, but they're like, they're not allowed to talk or text or whatever during the movies. But you mentioned
too. So I love Alamo.
Right. I mean, yeah.
I love Alamo.
You know, if you live in Texas, you know, and you gotta, you know, you gotta pay some respect, even though it's owned by Sony now. But, you know, most people, that's not how they associate going to the movies, right?
No, absolutely not. I think, you know, theater etiquette has taken a huge, huge nosedive. And I'm not even sure if that's a COVID issue. I think that's just a people issue. Yeah. I mean, it accelerated very heavily post-COVID, I think. But I mean, I think just in general, people just don't have the traditional theater etiquette. I mean, I used to work at a movie theater.
Yeah,
when I was going to school, and I had to like go into theaters and like shush people. But it's like, so many other theaters don't enforce that as heavily as they should be. And I think that's, you know, come back to the consumers. Now they don't want to go there because there's people being disruptive. And also, I mean, like, you know, I know movie theaters need to make their money, but I mean, when you look at the prices for concessions, I can understand why some people are opting out. I mean, I still go to the theater. My trick is I eat food before I go to the theater.
Bring your own. Is that popcorn into your pants? Or are you glad to see me?
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I have been shoving a box of Junior Mints into my waistband for 40 years.
Oh, yeah. It was funny because right before I started working for a movie theater, I would go to that same movie theater smuggling snacks in. And then I got hired and I had to like stop people from smuggling. It was so funny.
Suddenly the criminal becomes the cop.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I've been reformed.
What are you doing on this side of the law? But all right. So there are lots of issues with movie theaters. I understand that like not everyone can enjoy the sort of boutique or semi-boutique viewing experiences that I do. And I think a lot of movie critics are removed from it because they just go to press screenings. And so they're sitting in a theater with like at most 10 or 15 other people, all of whom are like taking notes. Mm-hmm. But I do think that like, you know, Anora was like, first of all, I don't think it's even made $20 million at the box office, but it's like, you know, it has, like all Oscar contenders, it has played in movie theaters consistently for months, right? So I think it's important that people like Baker, one of the best directors working, are like advocating for this stuff for a movie like his, which is essentially like the kind of like mid-tier realistic. It's a genre picture in its own way that Hollywood used to make a lot more of.
No, yeah, it's I remember Sean Baker. I'm pretty sure this is how he was describing Anora. He talked about like making an adult drama like for adults. You know, yes. This is a real world situation. You know, small stakes, but you feel it. You feel the characters. You feel their struggle, and it's, you know, an adult drama with adult situations, and it's not overblown or, you know, some big world ending thing. Yeah. It's just, okay, this is a slice of life story that you can feel compelled with.
Anora to me is like a 70s movie.
Oh yeah, definitely.
A quality 70s movie. Obviously the 70s were a time of great exploitation flicks as well, but that's not what this is. But I feel like that's what I feel like should be in movies. You should have like, you know, stuff for adults. You should have stupid kung fu movies. You should have blockbusters. You should have movies for kids. And instead you're like basically like the only movies that are allowed to really have a run in theaters are superhero movies or kids movies.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, like that's another thing, like with how theaters used to be, is it used to be you could walk in any day and you had a bunch of options. There was something for everyone.
Yeah.
And now with, I think a big part of it is Disney monopolizing the screens and kind of strong arming theaters. Like, hey, you need to show our movie on, if you have 12 screens, you got to show our movie on 9 of them. And then, you know, all the others can fight for the scraps. But it's, you know, there was a time where you could walk in and there were 10 different auditoriums playing 10 different movies throughout the day. And you could just kind of pick your poison. And nowadays it's, you got to really find your niche and find what you want to give your money to. And that's a hard choice to make for some people.
Yeah. And speaking of being a movie criminal, you could walk in and see and buy a ticket for one movie and just kind of hide out in the bathroom between shows.
Oh yeah.
I know you did that.
100%.
We all did that. I was doing that into my 30s. So, you know, it's like, that was only a teenage activity, but that's not really even feasible anymore because A, you have assigned seats, which is fine. And B, what are you going to go see? You're going to go see the, you know, Captain America New World Order again? I don't think
exactly.
So.
Exactly. There's not a lot of options. If you've seen 3 movies this month, you've probably seen them all. I mean, sure, like, you know, Alamo and some, you know, smaller theaters are playing more specialty niche stuff, more genre driven stuff, but if you're going to the big theaters, chances are they're only playing the same 3 or 4 movies that month.
Jacob Harper wrote a great piece for us on Book and Film Globe about the 90-day theatrical window. I hope to get him back in the pages of the publication soon. Thank you so much, Jacob.
Of course, thank you so much for having me.
There's always a lot of news in the entertainment business, but this week's, to me, the most significant news was that Amazon purchased the from the Broccoli family that owned the James Bond franchise. They purchased the intellectual property rights to James Bond. I know from personal experience that when Amazon purchases intellectual property, they don't sit on it and do nothing. I mean, anyone who's seen The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, knows that Amazon is not afraid to take bold steps when it comes to intellectual property. Not always good steps. I have a Book and Film Globe contributor, Jamie Mason, on the horn to talk about this new era of James Bond. I mean, we're definitely going to enter a new era of James Bond, right, Jamie?
It would appear that way. My understanding is that Eon Productions, which is the Barbara Broccoli, Michael E. Wilson partnership that has controlled Bond for the last couple of decades, has essentially, they've ceded creative control of the property over to Amazon, which basically means that Amazon is going to be able to take Bond and have their way with him. And that ought to be interesting.
Now, am I correct in remembering that you actually once wrote a James Bond novel?
Yeah, so I've written 2 Bond properties, and I should explain that these both happened at a time back when James Bond was public property in Canada. It became public domain. This changed with the trade deal that President Trump negotiated, copyright systems harmonized with the U.S., but for a brief period of time, Bond was public domain. And I produced a short story that was printed in a Bond anthology, and then I also did a Bond novel.
So was it James Bond was only allowed to have like Canadian adventures? So there was like a speedboat chase around Vancouver Island or something.
I did have skidoos in the Arctic in my novel, so there was that much. But no, it was basically, you know, for a period of a couple of years, Bond was you could write James Bond stuff in Canada without infringing on the copyright.
All right, so let's talk about the implications of Amazon taking creative control over Bond. Like, you know, Jeff Bezos, after the deal was announced, tweeted out, you know, who do you want to see play James Bond? You know, that's sort of like your baseline, like, oh, they're going to cast a new Bond. You know, that's, you know, Daniel Craig's Bond is dead and they're just going to reboot it. But I feel like that's like a red herring in some ways. And you sent me, the reason I decided to dragoon you into this conversation is because you sent me a message showing that Amazon had already announced that Florence Pugh was going to star in The Moneypenny Diaries, a prequel or a series to James Bond set in the 50s and 60s. I kind of thought that was going to happen, something like that.
It's funny that you should mention that, because I ended up getting into an online discussion where I happened to mention this, and I ended up getting piled on by people saying, oh, no, it's not confirmed yet. You know, just because it's printed in the media, nobody's confirmed this. So as it stands, I don't know if the Moneypenny Diaries are actually a go, but I'll tell you that it would certainly be one end of the franchise that they could exploit. As for, you know, where they could go, the Fleming estate, the Ian Fleming estate, has a number of Bond and Bond related properties that could be developed, including the Moneypenny Diaries, and there's also a series, Young James Bond, and both of these are approved by the Fleming estate, which is hard to get approval from.
Approved? How long have these been? Have these been like pre-approved?
The Moneypenny Diaries and Young James Bond, they've been out for a while as literary properties. They haven't been developed into film or television yet. I this might be an interesting moment to just mention that while Ian Fleming was still alive and in the early stages of his career writing James Bond, somebody did approach him with the idea of actually having a weekly Bond television series. And Fleming drafted a couple of ideas for scripts. So it was something that they were talking about.
The thing is, it's not a bad idea. You know, James Bond is not Shakespeare. He's like the template for all modern spy and action franchises.
Yeah, and you could definitely do a weekly series.
Yeah, and I think it could be popular. I mean, here's what people are, you know, there are a number of ways this could go, right? Like, it could go the way of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, you know, and just be this awful, tone-deaf, vaguely James Bond-esque thing. Or, you know, I don't know if you watch Reacher on Amazon Prime, you know, starring Alan Ritchson as Jack Reacher, but you know, that's an excellent adaptation of the Lee Child novels, much better than the Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah. And, you know, it occurs to me that given how Amazon tends to develop things, here's how I think this is most likely to go. I think that what they're going to do is they're going to recast Bond. They're going to have a new Bond, and they'll probably do a feature film, direct to streaming feature film. And then they'll use that and the new James Bond as a launching point for some kind of a series.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly not. It's too valuable a property to just sit on. And I think that it can be popular. You know, people have said that, you know, for instance, Disney ruined Star Wars by, you know, dragging the IP through so many different iterations. But you have, you know, there have been good and bad Star Wars shows. Like, you know, Andor is one of the best shows on television. And there have been other entertaining, you know, The Mandalorian, the first couple of seasons were great fun. So it's not like everything has to be a disaster. You know, if Florence Pugh actually does star in the Moneypenny Diaries, it'll, you know, she's proven herself as a action star, right? It could be good. I don't know. I'm not a James Bond purist. I don't care that much.
I wouldn't say I'm a purist either, you know. I think it's important for people to remember, like, I remember somebody back in the day talking about, let's make Bond black. Let's cast Idris Elba as Bond. And there was this big hue and cry. And I kind of quietly stepped into the conversation and said, you know, James Bond is make-believe, right? You can, and because James Bond is make-believe, you can do anything you want with James Bond.
James Bond could definitely be black.
Yeah, why not? You know, think about, here's a concept for you. Why don't you do, like, you know, the Bond novel I did was a Cold War drama. Could you imagine James Bond, early Cold War, circa 1950, as a black guy? Now that would be interesting.
Yeah, it's true. You have a chance to kind of do period pieces again. You know, I didn't really like the Daniel Craig. I like Casino Royale and Skyfall to some extent, but I didn't love the Daniel Craig series because I felt like it was very, you know, sort of grim and self-serious. You know, my preferred Bond mode is a little winky winky, right?
Yeah.
As is my preferred mode with everything.
It's interesting how the franchise has changed with, you know, the different Bonds. One of the Bonds who I think really didn't get enough credit was Timothy Dalton. He was only in for two movies. Apparently, he didn't really want to do it. They used him as a placeholder while Pierce Brosnan ran out his contract on the show that he was doing. So Timothy Dalton came in, and he gave probably the grimmest, most serious Bond ever. And in fact, in a lot of ways, I think the Timothy Dalton Bond was closest to the novel.
Well, it certainly wasn't the Pierce Brosnan Bond. I mean, that was just a handsome man in a tuxedo flying an airplane, which again is fine with me. I don't care. That's what when I go to the movies, that's kind of what I want to see, honestly. I don't know. I'm just not like a Bond doomer on this. I think that there's some potential for some fun stuff here. And I just hope that they are able to see the fun in it.
When you consider Bond in comparison or in perspective to sort of the entire body of work in espionage fiction, you know, this is not John le Carré, right?
Yes.
You know, that's the really serious stuff.
Yes.
Bond is meant to be a little bit campy, a little bit fun. Bond is really, it's adventure stories kind of wearing an espionage jacket.
Yeah. All right. Jamie Mason, thank you so much for taking some time out of your life as a secret agent in Canada to talk to me about James Bond. All right. Thank you so much, Jamie Mason. You can look for new James Bond content on Amazon Prime Video, whatever, maybe in the movies. I don't know. I don't know where the Bond stuff's going to come from, but Jamie and I will keep an eye on it and make sure it's good. If it doesn't please us, it's not going to please anyone. Thanks for Stephen Garrett for talking to me about the life and legacy and odd death of the actor Gene Hackman, who passed away this week. And thanks to Jacob Harper for talking to me about the 90-day theatrical window possibility. We would like to see a return to longer theatrical runs for movies, if possible. But you better behave yourselves if you go to the movies, or I will come and give you a stern, stern talking to. And that is the last thing that you want, believe me. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. Book and Film Globe is a product of Sea of Reeds Media, and you can find it at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Thank you so much for reading the site and for listening to this show, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.